Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 450, Update on 9/11, Proxy War, and the Underground Reich, being recorded on March 14th of 2004. WFMU archiving the For the Record Program's more recent shows streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows available for download only on Real Audio, as are the streaming shows. That is on a longer URL linked to both the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Real Audio equipped Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Listeners have inquired about how to assist the work that I'm doing. At the beginning of each description of the For the Record shows, there's a button to click on to assist the work that I'm doing. Be aware that the Spitfire website is now equipped with a search engine to help listeners locate information in the growing, massive body of Spitfire descriptions. And also, now, happily, thanks to a listener, the very pivotal book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by the late heroic Paul Manning, is now on the Spitfire website on Adobe PDF. It is available for download for free, and an understanding of that book is central to an understanding of this program. Listeners should also avail themselves of other texts to flesh out their understanding of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, the old book, The New Germany and the Old Nazis by T.H. Tettens, more recent books such as Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson, The Old Boys by Burton Hirsch, Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, The Beast Reawakens by Martin A. Lee, and Dreamer of the Day by Kevin Coogan will go a long way in that regard. Now, returning to the subject that we were talking about at the end of the first side of this program, that being Underground Reich involvement in the trafficking of nuclear secrets and the proliferation of nuclear technology, particularly to Middle Eastern nations and also, by extension, to North Korea, because North Korea has obtained some of the same technology through this Pakistani/European/Underground Reich nuclear smuggling nexus. We're going to return to an article from I Spy magazine, specifically their issue 13, page 18, and this is an article called "Stealing the Fire," about a documentary film of the same name. Now, we're talking about Karlheinz Schaub, who was working for Degussa and smuggling nuclear technology to Iraq. He was mentioned in a New York Times article dealing with this European/Pakistani nuclear smuggling ring. And returning once again to the subject of Karlheinz Schaub, in turn, a protege of Dr. Gernot Zippe, one of the principal figures in the Third Reich's atomic development program. Schaub's name was actually found on documents recovered by UN weapons inspectors in Iraq. He had been selling the centrifuge secrets to Baghdad. I Spy asked Nadler just what the Iraqis received for their money. Software, not hardware, he said. He then confirmed that with this data, Iraq could easily build a factory, a production line for nuclear bombs. The investigators tracked Schaub to Brazil, where he temporarily fled to avoid prosecution. Here also was the location of further obscure deals with high-ranking officials of the Brazilian armed forces. Note here, and this is really important, that according to Nadler, software, not hardware, was obtained by the Iraqis. If there's any way at all of preventing the dissemination of software, I'm not aware of it. And this is one of the real pivotal aspects of the danger in this smuggling ring, which is disseminating this technology around. Even though the Iraqis had not restarted their nuclear development program, they had been in touch with various elements, not in terms of launching September 11th, but there were contacts, as we looked at in a discussion of a book called In the Name of Osama Bin Laden by Roland Jacquard, not by any means a jingoistic or chauvinistic by a book not biased in any way towards the United States. There have been contacts between al-Qaeda and the Iraqi regime over the years through the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, and it appears that what accommodation was reached basically was sort of a contingency plan in which al-Qaeda would serve as a backup element for Iraq in the event that Iraq was knocked over by the United States. And indeed, U.S. intelligence experts had warned that the prospects of Iraq trafficking weapons of mass destruction or information about WMDs to terrorist groups was greatest if the United States knocked over Saddam Hussein. And it was just exactly that sort of a swatting of the hornet's nest that took place, and hence the danger. Again, what did Shab, in turn, apparently operating to a certain extent, perhaps unconsciously, as an agent of the underground Reich, what had he given the Iraqis? Software. Under what conditions was the WMD technology to have been trafficked around by the Iraqis? In the event that the U.S. knocked over Iraq, and of course that's just what happened. Among the elements that were apparently being contacted or in contact with Saddam Hussein's regime as possible backup units in the event such a thing happened, Al-Qaeda and the Muslim Brotherhood. Continuing and skipping down. Speaking of the German role in the proliferation of nuclear technology, Nadler said that between 1945 and 1990, Germany was the greatest proliferator of nuclear weapons technology in the world, unquote. It also appears that elements within the German government were complicit in this, and again, as I suggested on side one, underground Reich connected elements. Skipping down. On the German government's light sentence for Schaub and the suggestion that other people might be involved, Nadler was diplomatic. Quote, Schaub had a story and he stuck to it. He said that two other men who were now dead were involved, but it's quite clear that all this activity had to be monitored and known by the Germans. We can safely say that the case was woefully under-investigated, and as one person says in our film, the German government just wanted it to go away. Schaub took the secret plans of the centrifuge and sold hundreds of blueprints to the Iraqis. And on a recent television news program on Fox, Nadler said it is possible that Iraq may have sold the plans to Al-Qaeda, or I would say perhaps to anybody else. And again, it was software, not hardware, that they had. How do you control the dissemination of software? More about the German-slash-Nazi-slash-underground Reich links to nuclear smuggling. This is from the New York Times of March 4, 2004, an op-ed piece called Nukes Are Us by Gary Milholland and Kelly Motz. One of the major focal points of this article is the nation of Dubai and its role in as a sort of transshipment point for this nuclear technology. Skipping down, why ship through Dubai? Because it may be the easiest place in the world to mask the real destination of cargo. Consider how the Malaysian government is making the case for the innocence of its manufacturing company. Quote, no document was traced that proved, unquote, the company, again quoting, delivered or exported the said components to Libya. Quote, according to the country's inspector general of police, the real destination, he said, again quoting, was outside the knowledge, unquote, of the producer. One can be certain that if the Conring's European suppliers are ever tracked down, they will offer a similar explanation. Dubai provides companies and governments a vital asset, automatic deniability. Its customs agency even brags that its policies on re-exporting, quote, enables traders to transit their shipments through Dubai without any hassles, unquote. Next to Dubai's main port is the Jebel Ali Free Trade Zone, a haven for freewheeling international companies. Our organization has documented 264 firms from Iran and 44 from rogue regimes like Syria and North Korea. With the laxity of the Emirates' laws, there is simply no way to know how many weapons components have passed through. But consider some incidents that our organization has tallied, based on shipping records, government investigations, court documents, intelligence reports, and other sources over the last 20 years. In 1982, a German exporter and former Nazi, Alfred Hempel, sent 70 tons of heavy water, a component for nuclear reactors, from Sinochem in China to Dubai. The shipping labels were then changed to mask the transaction, and 60 tons of the heavy water were forwarded to India, where it enabled the government to use its energy-producing reactors to create plutonium for its atomic weapons program. The other 10 tons went to Argentina, which was interested in atomic weapons at the time. In 1983, Mr. Hempel sent 15 tons of heavy water from Norway's Norsk Hydro and 6.7 tons from Technob's export in the Soviet Union through the Emirates to India. In 1985 and 1986, Mr. Hempel sent 12 more tons of Soviet heavy water to India that were used to start the Dhruva reactor, starting to make plutonium for atomic bombs. The details of these transactions come from German and Norwegian government audits, but Mr. Hempel, who died in 1989, was never convicted of a crime. Again, note a former Nazi, and perhaps former in this context belongs in quotes, Mr. Hempel, again, using Dubai as a transshipment point for nuclear technology reaching the Third World. And one of the things we want to bear in mind in this context is the research, the landmark research of Kevin Coogan in his book Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International. I think that one of the most important concepts in understanding the gravity of what we're dealing with here is Yockeyite fascist philosophy. This is somewhat akin to the fascist third position, that it involves alliances between fascists and underground Reich elements and third world populations, Middle Eastern in particular, and far left elements as well. And this forging of Nazi and fascist elements with third world elements and far left elements constitutes a Yockeyite milieu. And I think that Yockeyism is one of the most important concepts in understanding what is taking place today. By the way, this should not be misunderstood as constituting an endorsement by Kevin Coogan for the working hypothesis that I've been presenting about September 11th and related concepts. Just where this all might lead is touched on in a chilling op-ed column by Nicholas Kristof of the New York Times. This dated March 10th of 2004. It's called A Nuclear 911. It reads in part, "A 10-kiloton nuclear bomb, a pipsqueak in weapons terms, is smuggled into Manhattan and explodes at Grand Central. Some 500,000 people are killed, and the U.S. suffers $1 trillion in direct economic damage." That scenario, cited in a report last year from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, could be a glimpse of our own future. We urgently need to control nuclear materials to forestall that threat, but in this war on proliferation, we're now slipping backward. President Bush, after ignoring the issue before 9/11, now forcefully says the right things, but still doesn't do enough. Quote, "We're losing the war on proliferation," unquote, Andrew F. Krepinevich, Jr., a military expert and executive director of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, says bluntly. I would add parenthetically, no thanks to this current administration, for reasons that we discussed at the beginning of this broadcast, skipping down. But all in all, the risks of a nuclear 911 are increasing. Quote, "I wouldn't be at all surprised if nuclear weapons are used over the next 15 or 20 years," unquote, said Bruce Blair, President of the Center for Defense Information. Quote, "First and foremost, by a terrorist group that gets its hands on a Russian nuclear weapon or a Pakistani nuclear weapon. One of our biggest setbacks is in North Korea. Thanks to the ineptitude of hardliners in Mr. Bush's administration and their refusal to engage in meaningful negotiations, North Korea is going all out to make warheads. It may have just made 6 new nuclear weapons. Then there's Iran, which has sought nuclear weapons since the days of the Shah, and whose nuclear program seems to have public support." Quote, "I'm not sure there is a way to get an Iranian government to give it up," a senior American official said. "Finally, there's the real rogue nation of proliferation, Pakistan. We know that Abdul Qadir Khan, the Islamist father of Pakistan's bomb, peddled materials to Libya and North Korea, and we don't know who else. It may be that A.Q. Khan and associates already have passed bomb-grade nuclear fuel to the Qaeda, and we are in for the worst," unquote, warns Paul Leventhal, founding president of the Nuclear Control Institute. It's mystifying that the administration hasn't leaned on Pakistan to make Dr. Khan available for interrogation to ensure that his network is entirely closed. Several experts on Pakistan told me they believe that the administration has been so restrained because its top priority isn't combating nuclear proliferation, it's getting President Pervez Musharraf's help in arresting Osama bin Laden before the November election. Another puzzle is why an administration that spends hundreds of billions of dollars in Iraq doesn't try harder to secure uranium and plutonium in Russia and elsewhere. The bipartisan program to secure weapons of mass destruction is starved for funds, but Mr. Bush is proposing a $41 million cut in, quote, cooperative threat reduction, unquote, with Russia. We're at this crucial point, unquote, warns Joseph Cimincioni of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, again quoting, and how we handle these situations in the next couple of years will tell us whether the nuclear threat shrinks or explodes, perhaps literally, unquote. One of the things that's very disturbing in this particular regard is the fact that the war on interdicting terrorist funding is being lost. In For the Record program number 447, we looked at attempts by the Bush administration, or elements within it anyway, at interdicting Operation Green Quest. That is the combined U.S. Intelligence and Customs Department operation that was aimed at interdicting the Al-Qaeda funding conduits. It busted a series of Islamic charities and businesses in Virginia and the Maryland Beltway area that not only were linked to Al-Qaeda and to Hamas, but also to Al-Taqwa, the Muslim Brotherhood, and through that, to the Underground Reich. Still more importantly, they were linked two elements within the Republican Party's GOP ethnic outreach organization, and efforts on behalf of stopping this operation were conducted by people close to the Bush administration, including Grover Norquist and Talat Atman, a close associate of both George's Bush, director of Harkin Energy, the George the Younger's, one of his failed energy companies, an individual close to the BCCI milieu, and an individual who sat on the board of directors of the Islamic Institute, one of the touchdown points between the Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Al-Taqwa milieu, and that of the GOP and the Bush administration. In addition to the Bush administration's interdiction of the war against terrorist funding, other countries are basically either dragging their feet or are deliberately obscuring efforts or frustrating efforts at interdicting terrorist funding. An article about the failure of international cooperation to interdict terrorist funding was published in Newsweek Online of March 4th of 2004. This is an article by Mark Hosenball and Michael Isikoff. It's called Nobody's Nagging. And again, the URL will be on the Spitfire website in the description for the Record 450. This reads in part as follows. An Egyptian-born businessman accused more than 2 years ago by U.S. authorities of financing international terrorism from the heart of Europe has evaded efforts to shut down his operations and is continuing to conduct business under new corporate identities, according to European and United Nations officials. The faltering investigation of Youssef M. Nada, the notorious former head of a Swiss and Bahamas-based Islamic financial network called Al-Taqwa, is the latest example of how the Bush administration's much-publicized campaign to dismantle the financiers of international terrorism appears to be losing steam and waning support from foreign governments, the officials say. Nada and several other directors of Al-Taqwa and related companies, including a mysterious Eritrean-born associate named Ahmed Idris Nasreddin, were formally designated terrorist financiers and in November of 2001 were placed on sanctions lists started by the U.S. Treasury Department after the September 11th terror attacks. Although they have never publicly disclosed much of their evidence against Nada, U.S. officials have said they acted on the basis of intelligence reports indicating that he served as the central banker for the Muslim Brotherhood, a secretive network of Islamic radicals that helped spawn Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda movement and other violent Islamic jihadi networks. Nada and his associates were also placed on similar lists maintained by the United Nations, signaling what was supposed to be a coordinated international effort to freeze his assets and close down his businesses. But today, officials tell Newsweek some of Nada's various business operations appear to be very much alive. Swiss authorities, who had raided Nada's offices and opened up a major criminal investigation, are on the verge of closing down the case, apparently unable to develop enough evidence to bring Nada to court, European law enforcement officials say. In the meantime, Nada has maintained business interests in Italy, Switzerland, and Liechtenstein. Nasruddin, his business partner, is believed to maintain his interests in luxury hotels in Milan, Italy. One way the two men have been able to continue operating is by exploiting loopholes in the international sanctions regime. Nada, for example, was supposed to have been barred from traveling outside his city of residence, a tiny enclave of Italian territory called Campione d'Italia that is surrounded on three sides by Switzerland and by a lake on the fourth. But the UN reported last year that Nada had traveled to Liechtenstein, a journey that he could only have made by transiting through Swiss territory from which he'd been banned. Nada's trip was focused on starting proceedings to change the names of two of the companies designated by the UN and the United States as terrorist financing entities. UN and European law enforcement sources said they could see no reason for Nada to seek to change the names of his companies unless they were still actively engaged in business or controlled some valuable assets and property. To try to find out what Nada was up to, authorities in Liechtenstein attempted to wrest control of one of the companies from Nada by forcibly appointing a former Liechtenstein government official as liquidator of the corporation. But law enforcement sources tell Newsweek that Liechtenstein's plan to take over the company failed, and Nada remains in charge of the operation. The Liechtenstein effort against Nada isn't the only one that fizzled. Swiss authorities last year served Nada with a formal notice that he can no longer enter Swiss territory, Newsweek has learned. Theoretically, because the Italian enclave where Nada lives is virtually surrounded by Switzerland, the only way he can leave is either by boat or air. But authorities acknowledge that Switzerland's borders with Campione d'Italia are rarely, if ever, patrolled, and that Nada has virtually carte blanche to leave when he pleases. In a telephone interview from Campione d'Italia this week, Nada insisted that he has no financial ties to terrorists and defiantly seemed to mock the efforts to keep him bottled up in his hometown. And I will include the full article in the description for this program. Skipping down still further, Victor Komras, a former U.S. government sanctions expert and a member of a recently expired United Nations task force on international terrorism, said the Nada case is symptomatic of the loopholes and weaknesses in international efforts to shut down terrorist financiers. He said foreign interest in the issue appears to be fading, as does United States leadership in pushing for more vigorous action. Quote, "This is an issue which requires constant nagging," said Komras, and, quote, "nobody's nagging," unquote. And again, the full article will be included in the description for the record program number 450. One of the key points about Nada and Al-Taqwa is that it is basically the financial network, Al-Taqwa that is, of the Muslim Brotherhood, in addition to being a primary funding source for Al-Qaeda and for Hamas. And again, for people that find some of my discussion of Underground Reich being preposterous, bear in mind that Youssef Nada is a former German intelligence agent. He worked for the Abwehr in World War II, and he helped the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, a key Axis spy and a founder of three Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS divisions. He helped the Grand Mufti escape from Germany at the end of World War II. More about the Muslim Brotherhood, this from an article on the website Winds of Change. The full URL will be in the description for the program. This is an article called "Tariq Ramadan Accused of Anti-Semitism." It is from Le Monde, and it is translated for this website. For several weeks, a federal judge in the state of Washington has had on his desk reports from European intelligence services implicating Tariq Ramadan in several investigations into the activities of Al-Qaeda. According to our sources, these reports were obtained by lawyers acting on behalf of the families of the victims of the attack on the World Trade Center of September 11, 2001. A lawsuit is currently being brought on behalf of 5,600 plaintiffs seeking damages and interest against the persons or groups suspected of having supported Osama bin Laden's organization. According to Jean-Charles Brizard, a former member of the intelligence services and now a private investigator hired by the victims' families, this international investigation has obtained the political and law enforcement cooperation of 30 countries. Since the end of 2002, the Geneva Islamic Center, where Tariq Ramadan sits on the board of directors, and of which Brother Hani Ramadan is the director, appears among the organizations under investigation. And skipping down, In addition to the allegation that Tariq Ramadan is the nephew of Omar Abdel Rahman and had met with Sheikh Rahman, convicted in connection with the first World Trade Center attack. Another charge against him, according to the investigations conducted by the lawyers on behalf of the families of the World Trade Center victims, is that the Ramadan family address appears in a register at the Altaqua Bank, which is one of the American State Department's list of organizations accused of supporting Islamist terrorism. And for the record, 447, we looked at the pivotal role of the Ramadan family and the Muslim Brotherhood in founding Bank Altaqua. This is from a German website. The two articles with which I'm going to conclude this program are from, the first one is from a German website, an anti-fascist website. This is an article by Anton Meyerle, M-A-E-G-E-R-L-E, titled "The Unholy Alliance Between the Swastika and the Crescent, Neo-Nazi and Fundamentalist Islamic Ties." And this concerns William Pierce, the head of a national alliance, the largest and arguably most important domestic Nazi group linked with the German NPD, which in turn is linked to people from Altaqua, such as Ahmed Huber. We've talked in For the Record 447 about how the Turner Diaries concludes the pivotal element in the climactic element in the Turner Diaries is a low-level suicide aerial attack against the Pentagon by the Nazi organization, the Order. We also talked about the fact that in 1998, in a broadcast titled "Stay Out of Tall Buildings," William Pierce, head of the National Alliance, warned that Osama is coming and that people who live in New York in buildings the size of the World Trade Center might want to wear hard hats. We've also looked at a number of evidentiary tributaries connecting the first World Trade Center attack, the Oklahoma City bombing, and the 9/11 attacks. Apparently, in the Turner Diaries, according to Anton Meyerle, there is this provocative passage. The neo-Nazi, writing under the alias Andrew McDonald, says he desires to see the 100 floors of the skyscraper fall. So apparently, there's a foreshadowing of the attack against the World Trade Center as well. The concluding item in this broadcast is from an Israeli website, Virtual Jerusalem. This is an article by William Grimm for the Jewish Press titled "Al-Qaeda's Neo-Nazi Connections," and of Andreas Strassmeier, alleged to be the superior of Timothy McVeigh in the Oklahoma City bombing attack, the son of Gunter Strassmeier, Helmut Kohl's chief of staff, and the architect of German reunification, and in turn the grandson of one of the charter members of the Nazi Party, we find this a fascinating document. In addition to training various neo-Nazi and militia groups, Strassmeier was involved in a number of very curious activities. According to an FBI report dated May 10, 1995, quote, "Additional documents reveal that at one time Strassmeier was attempting to purchase a 747 aircraft from Lufthansa. However, the reason for the purchase is not reflected in the documents," unquote. The events of September 11th may have given us a clue as to the possible reason why Strassmeier was looking to pick up a used 747. WFMU, archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio. Recent shows streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery. Older shows at a longer URL linked to both that address and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, which will carry a long description of For the Record program 450 within a week or so of the airing of this program. Don't forget to use the search engine on the Spitfire website. Get a hold of the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, available for free on the Spitfire website. It'll flesh out your understanding. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record Program 450, update on 9/11 proxy war and the Underground Reich, being recorded on March 14th of 2004. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.